There's just so much information out there that us as artists, we don't know. Nobody's like, hey, you need to know this, because all the people that know those rules don't want to share them because they want the benefits of that, right?
This is Richard Lego, a talented pioneer gameplay animator who has been in the industry since the early 2000s. He has played a key role on some of the world's most critically acclaimed games like Halo, Halo 3, and Destiny. He owns his own school called Animation Sherpa, where he teaches us all about the workflow he developed over the years. Richard's latest venture includes animating for PolyArt Games, where he dove headfirst into developing VR games such as Moss Book 1 and 2.
Home animators used to be like the pinnacle animator, right? It's like, oh, you're in games? Don't worry, you'll get to film someday.
Where do you stand with AI?
It is actually taking jobs away. And some studios use it as replacement. And then some studios are like, no, it's just a rough-in. We still need you to animate, right?
So. Hi, Richard.
Hi. This is off to a great start. We're very professional.
Do your friends call you by any kind of nickname?
Just Rick.
Just Rick?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or if they don't know me, they call me Rico for some weird reason.
Rico.
But yeah, I don't like that.
No. Rico in Spanish means that you're rich. So.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
Either rich or if you're trying to be really sleazy, sexy.
Ooh, maybe I should be okay with it. I just assume they are mispronouncing the last name. Swap the L for the R.
That's probably more like what's happening. Yeah. Well, thanks for having us here.
Well, thanks for coming out to my house.
We're very honored to be here. For context of people watching, we actually filmed this already once.
Mm-hmm.
But there was some technical difficulties with the audio.
Yep. That happens.
The audio technician has since been fired. We're really excited to talk to you. I know everybody in the community is really excited to hear from you. I've gotten so many pings asking me when this is going to release. So.
Oh, no
I'm
pressure.
Really happy. No pressure, Richard.
Jeez. That's Rico. I'm sorry.
Rico.
All right, we'll go back to Rick. Yes.
Would you say there's a difference between being a game developer and an animator?
Oh yeah, definitely. Game developers are all about the player feedback and feel, and that it's a bi-directional communication, and film is single directional. Mm-hmm. So with film, you entertain your audience, and your audience is hopefully entertained, and they kind of just watch the film. But with games, they're telling you with their button inputs or where they're looking if you're in VR, what they're thinking, what they're feeling all the time. So you're constantly having to come up with animation sets that respond to all these dynamic inputs. So it's more about crafting that player feel and that player fantasy than it is about telling a linear narrative. And it's a completely different mindset. It's more technical. It's more component, like there's smaller components that go into making like a big thing. It's not like getting a shot and animating shot end to end.
Right.
So it's just really different. And I think that's why it's hard for animators. I mean, we essentially do the same thing, film mm-hmm. and game animators. We open Maya, we animate, right? But the goal and how it's all put together is so different that it's really hard for animators to cross those boundaries sometimes and go back and forth between the industries. I know I would suck at film.
I've heard you say that, but I don't believe you.
Well, thank you. I don't know. You guys know so much more about camera work and layout and staging and stuff like that that I'd have to learn, you know?
I don't know. I feel like the roles nowadays are so isolated. There's like a team that does layout, a team that does the camera work, and then the team that does animation that you're kind of like, you feel like you're in your own island sometimes.
Oh, because you're just doing the
acting, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to hear about game developing. I feel like when you refer to yourself as a game developer first before being an animator, I kind of see it as like you trying to see the big picture of what you're making more than like focusing on the actual like action that you're doing, right?
Yeah, I think the longer you've been in the industry, that's more and more true too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think gaming industry, you have more autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Like with film, it's you're issued a shot and you work with the director on that shot, I'm assuming.
Right.
But with games, you're essentially issued a system. And then you have to go in, you have to technically figure that out with the engineers and the designers, and you have to come up with the content list that works in that system. And then it's all about getting that player feedback and feel to be right. So you make a lot more like autonomous decisions.
Mm-hmm. You jumped from a AAA studio, Bungie, to an indie studio, Polyarc. Can you talk to us a little bit about where you were at in your career or in your life where that pushed you to make that decision, and elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure, yeah. I was in AAA pretty much my entire career. Like, my first gaming company wasn't, but... Mm-hmm. And then I got Ravensoft after 2 years of being in games, and then Monolith, and then Bungie. And AAA studios work in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. Back in the old days, they operated more like a small studio, like where you'd have a lot more autonomy, and on a given day, you're doing something different, right? Even back in the old days, we did our own modeling and rigging for a lot of the characters. So as AAA got bigger and bigger and bigger, the roles started getting smaller and smaller because there were more heads in the pipeline. It became more about process. And I missed the autonomy and the creative opportunity that those smaller teams would allow for. Mm-hmm. And things at Bungie, you know, when I left, we were at like 800-something people.
Oof.
Yeah, and they got up to, at their peak, like 1,200, I think, talking to friends that remain there. And I just... Mm-hmm. I saw where things were going, and I saw this opportunity with some friends to go indie, and I wanted the boss fight. You know, like I had done leveling up. I had collected a bunch of potions, and I'm like, I'm ready to fight the boss. You know, and then we made the Moss Games, which was my boss fight, and it was just creatively the ride of a lifetime doing something like that. And I financially, it was a really dumb decision, but creatively, it was the smartest thing I've ever done. So it's give and take, you know?
Yeah, yeah. When I make decisions based like about my career, I struggle with that balance between like the creative like decision is usually not linked to the financially stable decision.
Isn't it a shame?
Why? Why is that the case? What are the biggest differences that you find within your life, your workflow as an artist? I guess you answered a little bit of that with what you said. With more opportunities and more autonomy, but like more specifically you as an artist, what are the biggest difference between working at a AAA versus working at Polyarc?
Well, my role was turning more into kind of like a manager mentor role, where I didn't work on the content as much anymore as the studio got bigger and bigger. And my role, like, it was more about sharing the knowledge, and it was less about doing. And that, even though some of that is exciting to me and I enjoyed part of it, I really missed the content. So being at a small studio allows me to still do that kind of stuff, but I can do it by doing the content. So instead of saying, here's how I'd approach it and describing it, I can say, here's how it turned out.
Right.
And then describe that. And that to me just... it feels more powerful. Like if you're someone trying to learn animation, or if you're working on a game together, that's more collaborative, and it's more like, it's more hands-on, it's more seeing results and helping to push things forward by being in the trenches. And that's, I think it's more valuable to your average animator too, you know, cause you don't question, like, do they know what they're talking about? Like, I've been in situations where I've questioned that myself, you know?
Right.
And then it helps me stay, like it helps me stay knowledgeable, because like as things change, as tools change, like all the game engines are every year, they feel really different by the end of the year. It helps me like, there's this new control rig thing in Unreal. Like, okay, here's how you guys use it. I banged my head against it for 3 weeks, you know. It's like, I wouldn't have known that if I wasn't in the trenches, you know? So there's just, it just, and then being able to be creative again, it just, gosh, you know, like make my own animations, just get better as an animator. Yeah. I can't do that if I'm just talking about it.
Are you ever in that headspace that we tend to be in because we're starting out, like where you're second guessing yourself and you're kind of, do you feel like there's like a lot of room for you to grow, or are you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I look at the stuff I did on Moss One, and at the time I was like, this is great, I love it. Now I look at it now and I'm like, God, all right, I wish I would have done this differently, or I wish I would have done that differently. Mm-hmm. And being in the trenches allows me to see that, because I'm still sharpening the knife, you know?
Right.
And I'm sure you've probably experienced it. Like, haven't you, like, look at some of your earlier work and just be like,
Oh, pretty much every single thing I make, I'm like, I look at it 2 weeks later and I'm like, oh, why? What was I thinking?
I mean, that's the journey of an artist, right? Like, so you know those Japanese, like, the old Japanese, like, samurai sword makers? Mm-hmm. They would spend 30 years learning the trade before they were considered sword makers, right? Mm-hmm. They had terminology for it. I don't know it all, but, mm-hmm. And then they'd spend the rest of their life like practicing it and getting better and better and better. And I think us as animators, we have that opportunity to do that kind of thing, hopefully, AI permitting.
You're getting ahead of the talk.
But I mean, it's true. I mean, if you've been doing this for 15 years, you've been doing this, I've been doing it for 24. If, you know, you get better every year, if you just keep doing it, you know, practice makes perfect and there's no perfect.
I always, this is also a bit away from what I'm trying to say, but from personal experience, it's funny that you mentioned that because I've always tried to, whenever I take a class or whenever I look for somebody to teach me something, mm-hmm. I always try to find those who are still active.
Yeah.
Which is tough because somebody who's still active means they have like their you know, full day, full-time job, and then they have to teach you later, which is like,
yeah,
asking a lot from somebody.
It is, it really is.
But yeah, that's what I looked at for when I was studying. So I,
and oh, my fridge turned on. That's okay. Hopefully that's all right.
Fine.
So I have a question for you then, like, mm-hmm. So what was your main catalyst for looking for that? Was it
the first college that I went to was actually with teachers that did not have any kind of work experience, or it was in Prague in Europe.
That's really cool.
Before I knew animation existed or anything, I wanted to study art and I didn't know what to do. I loved the educational system in Europe and I just like leaped and went to Prague and I studied there. And the teachers that I was learning from, I felt that the teachings were more subjective.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as, you know, really something that I could like take and then use myself mm-hmm. as a tool later. It was more like, okay, I could always join a group or like mingle with my fellow artists to find out more points of views. But right now I just need tools and I need them from people who are more like...
That are doing it, that are practicing, yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's
anyway,
good for you.
2 years in, it took me a while. 2 years in, I transferred. I found School of Visual Arts. I went to School of Visual Arts in New York.
Yep.
That's
a good one.
Which is actually a competitor with SCAD in New York.
I had considered them, actually, because I grew up right outside New York City.
I also consider SCAD.
Yeah. Well, I just figured the difference between the two schools is SCAD is further away from my parents.
Right.
So, of course, I chose that one, right? Yeah.
All right, so back to the original questions.
I want to call out that you have some amazing handwriting in your notes. Like, this is impressive.
I had to
You could not be a doctor. I'm sorry.
Well, I knew that already, but thanks. So the one thing I wanted to ask you is, do you have any advice with people who are thinking to do similar than you did? Like, people who are feeling like they need a little bit more autonomy in bigger studios. Doesn't necessarily need to be games.
Yeah.
But, you know, people who are feeling like they might have hit a wall and they want to venture out. Maybe there's something that you regret doing, a way that you did it, that you want to warn people about, or something you recommend.
So you mean going from AAA to indie or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, or doing something more independent, like less depending on big companies, I guess.
Well, there's always side jobs.
Right.
But that's hard because you put in 100% or more, sometimes mm-hmm. crunching at your main job. It's really difficult to feel creative and highly productive on your side job. So I did that a little bit with PolyArk. I did about 10 months of overlap with Bungie and PolyArk. Mm-hmm. Hopefully Bungie's not mad about hearing that just now. but that was the off ramp because that let me test the idea. To mm-hmm. see if it was a good one or not. Because if we, you know, after that time was over, had a good demo and we thought we might be able to get it funded, then it'd be worth leaving the studio. And that's how I tested the idea. So we had a demo and we had interest from investors. So I made the full-time leap. I like that approach. I think that was a smart approach. I wouldn't do that part differently. But a deeper consideration on the finances. Like, I knew indie would be hard financially for a while, and I had built a small nest egg of retirement funds, you know, through Bungie. I didn't know how long it was going to be at either no pay or low pay when I joined full time, and I didn't plan as well as I should have for something like that. So I think really consider your finances, really consider where you're at and whether you're capable of doing it, and then whatever money you put aside, I guarantee you it's not enough. But honestly, the creative opportunity, like, you know, when we announced at E3 in 2017, and, you know, just a small group of us, we went to E3, and here we are as developing our own game, going to reveal it to the world, and it's up on stage, and then, you know, they had the dancers and stuff before us, and then they show the moss, and we're just like, oh my god, we're here at E3 for our game that we made. And it was like the fanfare. We went out drinking, we had the little action figure with Quill, and she came with us, and yeah, right there. We had her at the table, and she didn't drink a lot, but it was cool. Like, that was our character, that was our game, it was like not somebody else's idea, it was something that we generated, something that we believed in, and it was received well. Unfortunately, actually, there's a funny story. At E3, something happened to the way they transitioned audio from what they were showing before to when they showed the Moss trailer, and the audio kind of cut out at the end of showing the trailer before they showed something else, and it sounded like no one clapped or anything. Like, it was dead silent. Now, in the theater, everyone was clapping for us, and we were like, yay! And then we watched it back later, we're just like, oh god, people must have hated us. But we knew that wasn't the case, because we were there. And, you know, it's just little moments like that. But, yeah, if I have advice, it would be to make sure you know what you're doing. To make sure you have a good idea, to make sure you stand a chance at some kind of success, and then just be aware that there's a high likelihood you won't be successful, and make sure you're set up financially for it. And I don't think I made a mistake, but I made mistakes separately from that overall big picture. I don't know, it's kind of hard to say. I'm wishy-washy, it depends on the day you ask me.
Yeah, I feel like that's all of us though. So it's super interesting to me that you kind of started out your career really early on in the game world, where, like, you know, all the consoles were really early on. You had a lot of limitations, technically speaking, and you sort of survive all of that until you got to, you know, almost like top of the line. Like, the models were so much better, the animation capabilities were so much better.
Yeah.
And then you saw what you had done. And then you jumped off the cliff to something completely different. And you started from scratch. That's kind of how I see the jump over to VR. Just because it's, like, so much different. I mean, there, yeah. I'm sure there's some stuff that overlap. But you definitely went... So the move can be looked at as very technically advanced. But it was actually kind of going back for you a little bit.
Because yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of limitations there.
Yeah, because when you're in VR, you have to be at, like, what, 90 frames per second on two screens.
Yeah.
So your character is going to be really low res on these, like, essentially handheld devices, the Quest headsets. It's certainly not like animating Kratos, is it?
And I don't think that a lot of people could handle that kind of... I feel like you were specifically set up in that position to have all, like, the tools and the confidence that you need to make that leap, because you were there through the growth of the gaming industry, so you could see basically what you could do with VR, right? Is that something?
Because it was like going back in time. You're right. Yeah. Completely spot on with that. It's Quill had, I don't know, we didn't even have a rig for the first game. I just animated on the joints, and she had a very low poly mesh. I think we were under 2K verts for her. And her joint count, I think total was just slightly over 100 joints, because we had a little bit in her face and she had fingers. But yeah, doing that again and going back to, like, like 2005, like, poly invert and joint count was, I don't know, it was kind of fun.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it would be, but...
Yeah.
But I feel like not everybody would, you know, they'd be like, oh, now I have... It's like you got all these tools and stuff and it's all working and then you're like, oh, never mind, I'm just going to go get a Volvo. You know?
Like, get a Volvo?
I don't know, that's what I thought about.
Direct shot at Volvo.
Sorry! I'm sorry. Wow.
Have you had any history with Volvos? You know, so those modern characters and those modern tools and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. they come with layers of complexity and make things. It takes longer to get to the creativity because you have to go through all of the attributes on the control rig and all the little details and all the things. It's like animating. I haven't done this, but I'm assuming animating some of these really high def characters takes a long time. And animating Quill, I can do, you know, like 2 or 3 decent looking animations for her in a day.
Yeah, I can see the appeal for sure.
Yeah, it's just fun. It's like, it's just jump in, do some stuff, knock it out. And if it doesn't work, you know, needing to throw out that animation, it's like, oh, just 2 hours, whatever. It's trash, gone. And you just go back to it and you just keep doing it. And it just felt more fun to me to get rid of all the overhead costs, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when you put it that way, it makes a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, if you were to animate Quill, you might be like, how the hell does he do that?
To be honest, I get overwhelmed with all the different bells and whistles and controls, so I usually...
Okay, good, yeah.
Yeah, I usually just, like, make a little proxy and animate that.
Just do that with the joints, and then you're good. That's
basically,
Quill. Yeah. Back when I was at Monolith, I had been a 3D Studio Max animator when we were using Character Studio and stuff back in the day because it was easy. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was done for you. You could just skin it and you're good to go. So I was introduced to Maya when I joined Monolith. This was back in 2004. Yeah, 2004. And my boss at the time, Matt Allen, we didn't have rigs. You know, they didn't have like control sets and you didn't reference the scenes or anything. You had a skeleton, you had a mesh. Mm-hmm. And then Matt goes, here, this is what a locator does. And he shows me how to control a joint using like this constraint in a locator. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you guys are absolutely nuts. Like, this is not how we need to animate. And there was like a little thing called a Scott box. Scott Alba mm-hmm. wrote this little tiny tool that essentially made an IK chain out of locators and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I started using it, and a few months in, I'm like, wow, this is actually really powerful. Because mm-hmm. It was just so simple. So then I started exploring, like, well, what else could we do with this? And I started digging deeper and deeper. And I realized I was able to make animations like at a pretty decent quality, pretty damn quickly using this approach. Now, Bungie had real rigs, like actual, like we had a rigging staff and everything. So we were, you know, using that pipeline and stuff, and I was mm-hmm. kind of using my workflow over it, but I didn't dive deep there. But when I joined PolyArc, I didn't have a choice. Like I had to do, like I did all the animation and rigging in Moss One myself. And I couldn't do that with a traditional pipeline. Because it would mean I'd need to outsource so much, or I'd need a team of animators. Mm-hmm. So I needed to do the same amount of work that a team of animators could do without losing quality in 2 years' time.
Right.
So what I had to do was just get faster. Mm-hmm. So it was, okay, well, how do we... I spent like a month just like playing with ideas, playing with mm-hmm. tricks. Like the aim... Like my favorite one that I use most is an aim trick, where I can just... instead of rotating this arm in like FK... I can set it into FK and then grab this, press the aim button, and it puts a point out in space, and then I do this. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, I'm just manipulating that curve. I can even throw physics on that point in space. So this way I can get natural overlap with the press of a button. I can do all that with like Quill's ears. I could just essentially pose them out and then just hit a button and it generates all the overlap and stuff for me for free. Mm-hmm. I could do that with like her spine, and there's just so many like center of mass tricks and all those different things that I do that just... put the data into its most useful form so I could automate as much as possible. Because I think most animators really want manual controls where they spend time like manipulating all these different attributes and stuff so they have maximum control. I want to go the opposite direction. I want less controls. Mm-hmm. I want less things to worry about. I want to be able to just focus on the core focal points of the character, pose that stuff out, control like the acting and all that kind of stuff. And then a lot of the tweening, I just want it to kind of just happen. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my workflow just makes all that tweeting stuff go faster and faster and faster, mm-hmm. to the point where I could do like Quill's wave animation took me about an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And it's like all that little nuance in her body is a button press. It's not me going in there and literally controlling right. all that kind of stuff. And it just feels so much better to me. And now I'm training my staff on how to use that. And we've got an animator that's been doing it for 28 years. My friend Jason, who was nervous coming into PolyArc learning this pipeline because he was all about, you know, doing everything manually. Mm-hmm. And then I showed him some of the spaces and some of the things. He's coming up with his own set of tricks. He's writing his own MEL scripts. That's awesome. And he's teaching me some of his spaces that he likes to use. And it's just like this infinitely deep topic because it's not like a very specific way of working. It's just a sandbox. And then you learn the basics, you learn kind of the interfaces and the depth of it you can just keep going. So he's coming up with different ways of doing things. I'm coming up with different ways of doing things. And we just keep getting faster and faster because we're not constrained by like a very prescriptive set of tools that force you to work in a specific way. It would be hard for me to go back to that now.
There's a lot of us who have been working at a company forever and they're used to a certain set of tools.
Yeah.
And anytime they have to work at anything on their own or even at a new company, like it's very challenging to find your way around or to really do anything.
Yeah.
Because you're so like predetermined, like you're predisposed to use those tools and that's kind of what you're depending on.
Yeah. And then you think of the idea of like, well, I'm going to try and learn something new, but you still have deadlines, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Your producer is going to be all over you if you try that on company dime, right? So you can't, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough.
My animator friends always push me to like start using different tools. And I'm always kind of like a little bit allergic to it because I like to, I would prefer the way that you're doing it where you like learn how to improve your workflow itself and not rely on a specific set of tools.
Yeah.
That may not always be there for me in that way. And you know.
Yeah. You leave that studio that you're at and then you have to learn a new studio.
Or anything changes.
And yeah.
And that's kind of how you set up your school, correct? Like you're mm-hmm. teaching them the way that the workflow is and not so much, you're not like selling a button for it to work. Like you're kind of teaching the back end of it.
Well, if I wrote the button, it would probably break. So I don't want to sell that button. I do give away some scripts for free, but yeah, you're right. The school is all about teaching that workflow. And the thing for me is like, if I were to go to work at a different studio and they have their rigs, the way they're set up, and they probably will have recommendations on how to use them. Mm-hmm. Of course I'd learn all that stuff because, you know, I want to see what they've got and there might be some cool things in there that I'd benefit from. But then I'd also take this workflow that I've got and I'd apply it over the rigs. Mm-hmm. So any of the downsides to whatever they might be doing, I just take them out of the pipeline right off the bat.
Yeah, get out of here.
Yeah, because I'd just be able to say, okay, well, I'm going to make my own rig on top of this rig mm-hmm. using this workflow because it can be ported to anything. As mm-hmm. long as I have access to translation or rotation, I'm good.
Mm-hmm. Do you use any other tools that are like commonly used by animators other than your own workflow?
There were some nice curve tools that Animbot had. But my license ran out, so I stopped using them.
Classic.
No, for the most part, I just do my own thing. I could benefit from those curve tools again. Mm-hmm. I should really up that subscription again.
Playing games was considered to be like a pretty nerdy thing back when you started out.
It kind of still is, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, that's where I'm going because I actually think it's grown quite a lot. Like there's a lot of like very popular people who are streaming games nowadays. There's even money to be made by playing games.
Yeah.
That didn't used to be there before. I wonder if the game developer role has also sort of had the same trajectory where it used to be sort of not known at all and now it's a little bit more sought after.
Yeah, film animators used to be like the pinnacle animator, right?
Right.
It's like, oh, you're in games? Don't worry, you'll get to film someday. You know? Yeah. And it used to be a pitiable thing. And now I think they're peer level where, you know, it's just a valid approach to doing the industry, how you want to work. But yeah, I think it's changed a lot over the last few years. And what you said is spot on. It's more socially acceptable. You don't see moms crying Satan whenever someone wants to play Harry Potter. You know. I'm thankful because now we're getting a lot more film people applying for jobs
at
game companies. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'd say probably about 78% of the applicants we get are from film now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, I'm not gonna say it flipped, but I'm gonna say that I think there's a lot more film animators out there that are interested.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually hard to hire film straight into games because it's just there's so many differences.
Right. Have you had the opportunity to try and transition someone over to games?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been interesting. Some animators really take to it like that. They're gamers. They understand gameplay. They can go in and say, oh, here's how the system would be broken down. I get it. And be able to do that. And some of them don't play games.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones that kind of have a harder time making that jump. Because in games, time isn't linear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you work on a shot and you can guarantee that this is the sequence of events and it's always going to play out that way. You have to kind of craft things where everything's modular and you're fitting all these little tiny components together. And that, at the core, I think is what makes it harder for a lot of film animators to come over because they keep trying to tell a story, a linear story, when really the story is how all the pieces fit together and what the player chooses to do with them. And it's tough. I mean, just like if I were to go to film, I mean, just switching industries is hard, you know?
Do you think that the education towards games has caught up, or is it still behind?
Well, I haven't taken any of the classes on that stuff, but I know that, yeah, so many colleges teach you how to make games now.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. I don't know the quality of those.
Yeah, classes. I don't know that it's caught up 100%. I know when I was in college, we had some issues with that there wasn't enough game.
Yeah.
There wasn't very many game animators teaching anything. All the animation that we learned was film or commercial.
And then you had to figure out how to apply that to a game,
right,
and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that
And iAnimate came up with one game thing. I think that was the first one I realized where there's some game.
Yeah. They did a good job with
classes.
That too.
Yeah.
Rick and Dave, Rick Arroyo and Dave Hubert were the catalyst for that, and I was one of the first instructors that they hired for that, and that was fun because it was like all of a sudden we're teaching no, you don't need to make a long shot that tells a story, you need to make 8 different sword swings that describe desperation,
right?
And it was very different, you know.
Yeah. There have been a lot of layoffs in the game industry lately. I don't know if you've heard.
Mm-hmm. How could we not?
Have you ever been laid off?
No, I'm one of the lucky ones.
Wow.
I would have been laid off a few times. I saw the writing on the wall and I ditched while I still had the opportunity before it was flooded.
Right.
But for the most part, I've gotten lucky. So my first company, Sunstorm, folded about 6 months after I left.
Okay.
Kind of saw it coming. Ravensoft is still fine. Bungie they've had some layoffs recently, but that was the first time they've ever had layoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So I got lucky with where I worked.
Do you like the direction in which the game industry is kind of headed?
Yes and no. Right now there's industry consolidation happening. And anytime there's industry consolidation, it kind of limits the playing field. It happened in textiles. It happened in transportation. It happened in tech. It's good when your studio gets bought and you own stock. Like what happened with Bungie, but it does start causing certain parts of the industry to shrink or to refocus, and I think that's what happened with Microsoft and Activision recently. So it's good and bad. I think a lot of spin-off studios end up coming from events like this. Like you get people that get laid off and now they go start their own indie studio and then they get bought later. But I also think that the tech industry, 20, 30 years ago, Microsoft defined a boom bust cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way for investors to feel comfortable. That's the whole point, where, you know, they have their boom and they grow bigger than they need to grow to show growth to investors. And then these investors give them more money. And then when they get too big, they lay off people to show that they're they're being good corporate stewards and they're looking out for the benefit of the studio, and this is just a downturn. And it's like this artificial thing that I think tech companies all kind of synced up on, like a waveform that just goes through these patterns, right? And I think the gaming industry didn't used to join them, but the gaming industry is now so tied to the tech industry that it's now become part of it. So what we're seeing right now is a natural waveform contraction on a lot of these studios. The industry itself is still growing like crazy. Like Microsoft, I think, was up $24 billion this year, even though they just did all these layoffs, right? And I think the layoffs come from the Activision acquisition and then some other in the natural waveform and a few things. They're going to grow again. So probably by the end of this year, you're going to start seeing them hiring up like mad. And then another 8 years from now, we're going to go through another round of layoffs again. It's just going to keep happening. It's just the way the industry works. I don't think that means it's bad. I don't think it means it's good. I think it's just the natural way of things. And I think a bunch of indie studios are going to pop up now because of it.
I love indie studios. I really hope they do. Every time, I think also like when, I think when Blue Sky closed, which is not game, but I was like crossing my fingers that all of them would just like start their own studios and like we'd start to see some variety and like people like exploring the art in a different way, which I feel like we're all kind of making the same thing right now.
Yeah, now Weta closed now too because Unity shuttled them in their recent layoffs. It's like, there's going to be like Weta 2.0 with a different name.
Yeah.
Those people are not going to just stop working.
Right,
you know?
Right. I wanted to see if you have any advice on how we could like shield ourselves from all these cycles of layoffs or... And you haven't been laid off yourself, so it's kind of a tough question for you, but...
It's really tough because there is no bulletproof shield here. Usually when there's a contraction in the industry, there are victims, and it's just the way it works, and it's unfortunate. I think that the best shield we have is investing in our own skill sets. Usually in these situations, the ones that struggle the most are the ones that inspire the least. When you, and I don't mean that in a condescending way, if you are a really good animator and you're at top of your game and you're applying for a job with somebody that isn't as good, you're going to get the job, right? Because you have a better portfolio. And that's just what it comes down to, right? Every industry is that way. It's not unique to animation. It's just our form of a resume is a reel, right? So invest in your skills, invest in your abilities, and in the tough times, you will likely get the job quicker. And then there's also unionization. I think that the industry really needs to unionize. And it's difficult because there are a lot of studios out there pushing against it, or unions aren't cheap. You know, it might cut into your bargaining rights or your own autonomy. It might cost some money out of your pocket to support the union. And then what is the value of it? Like, how do you quantify it, and how do you even do it? Like, I if I were to start a union, I don't even know where to start, right?
Right.
So it's tough to hear that message. It's tough to act on that message. And I think that the industry just needs to educate itself on that topic a little bit more. I need to educate myself on that topic a little bit more. I'm with you guys, you know, I'm with everybody in the trenches on that one. And I think if we got unions to be more predominant, I think it would be a semi-shield against the natural cycle of things. Although you can see in film, it's not foolproof. You know, they've been in unions for years and it hasn't changed much. Well, I mean, it's helped, but I mean, they have layoffs too.
Yeah, yeah.
Whew. Sorry, was that heavy?
No,
you had to shake it off.
I just realized how heavy my question was. Glad we're out of that one. you also mentioned previously about like the difference between like just being a salaried employee or having some stake in the game, like some kind of ownership of the company, if you can.
So when you have stock in a studio and then you leave that studio and you've got your stock exercised or whatever, you know, whatever vesting schedule and exercising you do, that studio gets bought years down the road and then you get paid. That's where a lot of the money in the industry is. It's in ownership of components of the industry. So like either you're working on a third party tool, and you have ownership in the company that makes that tool, and then that tool gets absorbed by Microsoft, some other big tech company, you get a big payout. The money you make in the synergy is not in your salary. It's in what you own. And it's not like you could just say, I want to own something, you know, like.
Yeah. Like, how do you go up to Blizzard and you'd be like, can I own 5%, please? How much?
Well, I think that's the downside of AAA, right? Like, you might get some like tiny little bit of stock when you join a AAA studio, depending on how high level your role is. Like, if you get a job at Microsoft and you're high level, you get stock vestment. If you're low level, you don't. You just get your salary, right? So like, how do you get that stock? And like, a small studio like Polyarch, you know, we give everybody stock who joins us because we're tiny, right? We can afford to do that. That's part of our investment. And plus, at tiny studios, you can't compete with Microsoft Pay. You can't compete with Meta. You can't, you know.
Yeah.
Just, we don't have the money to pay those wages, right? So we compensate with stock. Mm-hmm. And if years down the road Polyarch closes, it's worth nothing.
Yeah.
Right. But years down the road, if Polyarch gets bought, it's worth a decent amount. Mm-hmm. And I'll probably make more money from that than I would ever from whatever salary I've made in my 8 years. And I think artists don't know that. Like, how do you know that that's important? How do you know what it is? Like what is an option? What is a grant? What does exercising mean? Mm-hmm. How do you pay taxes on that? Like, there's just so much information out there that us as artists, we don't know. We're not given information to, and nobody's like, hey, you need to know this, because all the people that know those rules don't want to share them because they want the benefits of that, right? So it's hard. I'm happy to talk about it, but it's don't know if I'm saying the right thing because I'm just an artist too.
Yeah. How were you able to convince the suits that last 10% of polish is worth their investment?
Ah, what a great question that is.
Or did you also fail?
Oh my god. No, this is like the question for me for the last few years. Yeah. Alright, so I just literally wrote a document about this at Polyarch. Like, literally on Friday. Okay, so alright, we need to do like a ledge jump climb thing in Moss, right? So you have Quill and she needs to get up this ledge, and the ledge could be at varying heights. So production will say, well, just do an animation that can scale and just like the height difference, whatever, and just one animation. This way we can make that one animation and save a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And of course, that would meet the goal of being efficient, but it wouldn't meet the goal of making a compelling game. And so then there's the goals of the studio. Like, one of the goals of Polyarch is compelling characters. Well, is that one animation going to be compelling when every other game studio does that same one animation? Mm-hmm. Are we meeting that studio goal now? Well, I'd argue that we are not. Mm-hmm. So what I ended up doing on Moss Games is we have three different jump heights and we have a blend space for each. Each blend space has six samples in it. And you're probably thinking, oh my God, it's a lot of content for just that little thing. Now, multiply that by every system in the game. Mm-hmm. And Quill literally has thousands of animations in her. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are superfluous. Ooh, what a big word for like not enough coffee. So like, I just did them because we're an indie studio and I can get away with it, and everyone's going to be like, wow, that looks amazing. And you know, then the reviews come in and people call it out, not directly, but they say Quill feels compelling, right? Okay. We win. Right.
Right.
So it's easy to convince a small studio leadership when you're one of the leaders that's exactly something that's important to do. How do you do that at a big studio? That's the hard part. And I think it's just a matter of, clearly communicating the value. Cause I think that values something that's hard to quantify, right?
It's a bit subjective, right?
Kind of, in a way, yeah. Like, if you look at something, you say, this feels compelling to me, and then a business person will say, what does that mean to sales, right? So like, this is the Valve problem. Like, when you go to Valve, you need to justify your role as part of being a Valve employee. That's why they hire very senior people that understand the business of it and how their creative and subjectiveness relates to, you know, income or value for the studio. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that most studios expect of their employees. You know, they just want to have you work from this production list, right? So like at Bungie, there was an opportunity where me and a few other people were like, wouldn't it be cool if we had these emotes in the game? And I just started making some animations. And, you know, of course my producer's like, yeah, you didn't ask for permission for that. I'm like, you're right, I didn't. And I just kept going. Because he wasn't wrong. She wasn't wrong. And, you know, eventually we start talking about, okay, well, you know, how do we sell these? How do we add these to the game? And then we had this big debate about whether we want the characters to dance, because do guardians of this realm dance? You know, like...
I would have loved to be in that conversation.
Oh my god, it was a studio-wide, like, really intense debate about do these guardians dance? And there were two very, very strongly felt camps on that one. I was definitely in the dancing side, because I figured whether the guardians dance or not, our players are going to want them to.
Yeah.
And if our players want them to, they'll spend money on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then we added that, because it's money you could spend on the game that adds to the value of the game for our players, for the company. It makes it so we can invest in more features, make the game even better, because now we've got this additional revenue, and it doesn't affect the balance of the game mm-hmm. in any way. So I pushed really hard for that, and then Emmy Chung came in, and she really organized the effort and got it all working, and it, a bunch of other stuff kind of all came together, and it wasn't just me, it was a lot of people, you know, but that was my contribution, was the animation side of it. And it's stuff like that, it's like, if I didn't just say, I'm kind of doing this, then it wouldn't have happened, right? But how do you do that and not get fired? I don't know. Like, how do you convince somebody that there's a value in something? And I think that's a culture at every different company. Like, if you have a very micromanaging company that just mandates you do from a list, then the best way to push those features through is with a resignation letter. And find a company that lets you do that kind of stuff. So it's difficult. I don't think every studio would allow for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like... this unclimbable wall.
It depends on where you are. Like at Polyarc, the wall is paved for you. All you have to do is just choose to climb it, you know? And they want you to. But, you know, at some other studios, they get very upset about that, you know?
When you're looking to hire somebody, what is most important to you?
Ooh, vision.
Do you ask your connections for somebody when you're ready to hire somebody? Or are you looking at resumes and reels?
I don't care about resumes.
Or reels.
Definitely reels. Sometimes through connections. But I don't like doing that too much, because then I end up getting an echo chamber of okay. colleagues. I really like the diversity that comes with no names.
Okay.
And it really comes down to reels and then questions. So like in the interview, I'll say, okay, what's your favorite thing about Moss? And they'll say whatever they have to say. And I'll say, okay, why is that important? And if they have a good answer for why that's important, then it tells me that they're seeing the opportunity.
Right.
And that means that they have vision for new ideas, right? It's when you have somebody that's very process-minded, it's very difficult, because they're like, well, you know, I know that the gaming industry works this way. That for an attack system, these are kind of the standard ways we approach it in the gaming industry, and we produce these clips and we make sure that the arc happens and the frame hits at this, and that's how I do my job. It's like, well, that's how you do a generic job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you stand out with that? Like, right. How do you do something that's compelling or unique that will make the industry stand up and say, wow, that looks cool, mm-hmm. as opposed to, yeah, that's exactly how it works, you know?
Right.
So finding people that have that mind, that really wants to see the opportunity in something and has a vision for how it could be, means more to me than anything else. Even if you're not the greatest animator, but you have this crazy vision that you can actually talk about, which is also a key thing, being able to communicate well.
Say you have a group of five people, and mm-hmm. they're all very, very, very... vision-oriented, that they want to try their own things, they're kind of very independent in the way they work, and they're constantly pitching stuff. How do you get anything done?
That's a really good question.
Is there a balance? But...
Yeah, I think there is, because I think there's vision, and then there's the ability to collaborate.
Right.
Right? And if you have vision but you don't know how to collaborate, then everyone's going to go off in their own direction, and right. you're kind of screwed. So I think there's some baseline minimums for... Like, working at Polyarc, for example, it's like, yeah, you don't have to be the best animator to get the job at Polyarc. You do have to have vision, but you have to be good enough to hit the quality bar
right.
at a reasonable speed, you know? And, like, you don't have to have, like, you can have a vision, you can have ideas, but then you can also see, like, when you talk to the team, like, okay, the team is resonating well with this idea, or the team is willing to experiment with this idea, or okay, I explored it and it didn't work, so now we're going to try something else. It's I think it's a mix of, like, getting to know the context of the situation you're being put in, getting to know the goals of the studio, and then helping to collaborate on a shared vision, but contributing to it, as opposed to saying, you know, I know we're making Moss, so what I really want her to do is hold a gun.
Right.
Because I think that'd be really compelling. Like, it wouldn't, it's so far out of context, you know, like, it just wouldn't work, right? So, like, being able to read the room and find out what fits in a given place and understand the context of things is key. And then once it happens, like, you could kind of let people do their thing.
Yeah.
Because then you know that at least they're within the realm of possibility. So, like, I'm all about, like, letting people, like, I don't do drawovers. I don't, like, heavily critique anything. I'm just like, okay, I'm going to show you my workflow instead. So this way you can come up with your own way of doing things, but you just understand the workflow, the context better. Or they might want to explore, like, I had one animator who was, like, really wanted to do a bunch of hints that had some, like, really over the top animation. And even though it didn't quite fit.
That's hard to say, actually. quite fit quill.
Yeah. Oh, you did it. You need to switch seats here. I'll ask you some questions. she had her own way of doing it. And I'm just like, yeah, go for it. Like, as long as we hit the quality bar and as long as it still feels like her, just explore however you want to explore. Because I think that creativity adds a dimension to the character that I didn't. Because I only have, like, a certain vision that I'm going for, right? Like, I'm only one person. It's like the wider we can make that, the more appealing the character will be overall, the more robust it'll feel. It's like, that adds more. I want that. I want, you know, staff to be able to bring that to the studio, you know?
But I love what you said about, like, being able to read the room and, like, being able to connect. I don't think that's very common. Or how can I say that? Like, I think somebody who is able to read this room is not necessarily going to be able to read that room.
Yeah.
So even if you're good at reading a room, doesn't mean you're going to be good at reading all the rooms.
I'm going to ask you a question now, if you're okay with it. Have you ever worked at a studio where you're just like, man, I know I'm a good animator, and I think that the studio's doing good things. I just don't feel like I quite fit.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's not on you. It's not on them. It's just sometimes the alignment's not there, you know?
I mean, obviously you always go through a phase of, like, questioning yourself and your skill, because you're like, oh, maybe I'm not getting the attention because I'm not there yet or whatever. But I definitely have felt that situation where I feel like I don't fit in here. And it's not anybody's fault. Like, you know, it's just a matter of that. It's not my room.
Yeah, every studio's got its own culture and its own way of doing things, and it doesn't fit everybody all the time. It's not like Lego pieces, you know?
Yeah.
Lego pieces.
I was gonna ask you what your supervising style was like as well.
Very loose.
Yeah.
I don't like heavy management. Like, I'm a stickler for animation quality. So even if you're not the world's premier animator coming into the studio, that doesn't matter to me. It's just I'm having an open-mindedness to the workflow is where my brain's at. Because if you have an open-mindedness to the workflow, then you have an open-mindedness to growth. And that's what matters most, right? So then it's just constantly teaching the tools, constantly giving examples, and then letting the creativity happen from there. I don't do drawovers. I don't believe in micromanagement. Because the moment you're micromanaging somebody and telling somebody, I want you to do it specifically like this and specifically act this way, you're not getting that creativity that really brings a character to life. You're just getting a process that's being conformed to. And I'm anti-process, because I think process is the white cane that you give to people without vision. I think if someone has vision, that process can actually prevent them from from finding or from executing on that vision. But it's all about, at that point, collaboration, reading the room, understanding goals, and just making sure that we're all aligned on that stuff.
Yeah.
It's hard. And it fails sometimes. And I've really screwed up as a manager a lot of times in my past.
But you don't waver from that.
I don't know. I think those experiences have brought me to that, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I used to actually be a real hard ass. Mm-hmm. Back when
I can't picture that.
Well, I was there was a guy named Tom Jecht who gave a really nice TED talk a few years ago. TEDx, he'd correct me on that if he was here. Mm-hmm. he was a really good animator. But, you know, he was new at the time. He was a contractor on Halo, and I was pretty harsh on him with some critiques. And I think about that, and a few of the other animators I gave harsh critiques to, because I was focusing on outcomes and instead of focusing on growth. And that was bad, because I was worried more about the schedule than I was about the people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Roberta Brown, my mentor on this topic, and then my current mentor, Tam Armstrong, who is our CEO at Polyarc, have really helped me come around to, it's about the people, it's about collaboration, it's about growth. And I've done a complete 180 with my style because of that. And I think that's important because as an artist, I was worried about my own art. Mm-hmm. And as a manager, it's tough because you don't know what the hell you're doing. Because it's not what you've been studying all that time, you know? Mm-hmm. So being open to learning how to do it properly is important. And even though I still don't like it, I mean, at least I'm not terrible at it anymore.
Okay. I'll try to find some references on that and cross-check you.
Is there data out there on that?
I don't know.
Could you send it to me if there is? I'd love to read it.
I have been supervising a few times, and I always struggle with this. I feel like with every project, it's a little different. For you, you're looking at it more as like a long-term situation. Like, your comments are more towards like, if you're all working in one studio and you plan to stay at that studio for a long term, then you're focusing on the person's growth or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you're just working with freelancers for a very short amount of time,
it's different, yeah.
It's a little different. Like, things are a little different. It depends if it's a reoccurring freelancer. Maybe you can see things a little bit more of a growth mindset, but...
That's spot on. Yeah, that context really does
change it really, a lot. Yeah, it really changes a lot. But I do find that I get this type of answer from a lot of the people that I look up to the most are always answering it in this way. I don't... It's interesting because I feel like there's maybe I should listen.
You know, I think that what I've noticed is everybody's different. So like, some people really need the process and that very hands-on specific feedback.
Right. Personality. You mean like different people. Yeah.
Like they just resonate with it.
They just need it. Yeah.
Yeah. We had somebody working for Polyarc who needed that and who was a lead at some point themselves. Mm-hmm. And currently a director. Mm-hmm. And that person, I think, directs that way. Mm-hmm. And we just kept missing each other because it just didn't hit me that way. Mm-hmm. I just didn't feel right to me. And I felt like I was constraining if I tried to go that way. And mm-hmm. I tried keeping it open and just focus on vision. And that person was like, just tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And like, and it just never felt right. And I that person, I don't think, left on very happy terms, which is unfortunate because mm-hmm. I thought that person was amazing. Mm-hmm. And it just, a missed opportunity. And mm-hmm. It's hard and it's none of it's easy.
Yeah, yeah. So many different people, so many different cultures too, now that we're all working remotely, you have to accommodate to cultures as well. So that's another layer of complexity there.
Yeah.
Well, I have some questions from the community. So I'm going to ask you these. This is kind of like the final round of questions.
Liko, why do you suck so bad? I think I know who asked that one.
Work from home, yay or nay?
Yay.
Yay?
Look at this room.
True. It's pretty gorgeous in here. It's really cozy. Oh my goodness.
Well, when you're starting out and you are an extrovert, those are the scenarios in which someone will really want to be in an office.
Right.
But when you're an old fart like me, and you got a family, and you're really introverted like me, like this is heaven.
Right.
Never having to go into a studio again. God, I hope that's the case.
Do you ever go into Polyarc?
No.
Has your work-life balance changed after your move to an indie studio?
Yeah, it got worse.
It got worse?
Yeah.
That's what I was expecting, actually.
I mean, well, all right. So when you're at a AAA studio, you're doing that work for the paycheck, right? You're not, I mean, sometimes you're doing it because you really believe in the project. And I think, you know, like, I really believed in, like, Monolith. I really loved our projects there. Like, I was really into them. But I think for the most part, it's somebody else's idea.
Right.
Like, it's not your idea. So there's only so much you can be invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
But literally when you go to work and you're making your idea, that changes everything. Mm-hmm. And work doesn't ever stop. Like,
right.
In the middle of the night, you're waking up, like, writing down ideas. Like, like so what does overtime mean
so
in
no
that situation?
Balance.
No balance. No sleep, no nothing. I crunched more on Moss 2 than I did on any project I've ever worked on in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally more than half the time on that project was spent in crunch. Like, 70, 80-hour work weeks.
Cool.
And it's because I had so much of myself invested in it. It was unhealthy. Not because the studio was doing anything unhealthy to me,
right,
but because I was being unhealthy about it.
Yeah.
And I did that to myself. Like, Polygon didn't do that to me. I did that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, if I was working for a paycheck or for somebody else's idea, it'd be easier to just be like, nope, sorry, it's 6 o'clock, I'm out.
I still have problems with that, and I'm not working on my own stuff. The community is dying to know something.
Uh-oh, I don't want to kill anyone. Let's answer this question.
Where do you stand with AI?
Ooh, I knew you were going to ask. All right, yeah, it's scary. I mean, it really hasn't invaded game animation too much yet. I know Unity's doing AI game animation stuff. Really all it is just a mocap selector. So it's like, it's not really predominant in my world yet, but I'm seeing it in film, like AI driven animations. I see Marvel doing the, what was it, that recent Marvel show with
I forget the name of it, but we did see a couple episodes.
Yeah,
I don't remember the name.
It was the whole intro sequence was done through AI.
Yeah.
It's,
you could tell,
yeah. And it has an interesting look to it, but it all kind of looks the same.
The funny, like, the really awesome perspective that you have that not a lot of us do is you were there before mocap was introduced.
Yep.
You were there when it was being marketed to animators and how everyone was scared about it and everyone was going to lose their job, so
yep.
on and so forth. And you're here afterwards and
yeah.
you're seeing how it's used and you're kind of an advocate for it now. You
mm-hmm.
like using it. That's something that you, you know, is... Do you think that AI is potentially similar to that, or...?
It's... Yes. In some ways, yes. So it really depends on the perspective you come at it from.
Mm-hmm.
Like, imagine the world as a donut. You're inside the donut. I'm getting hungry. And you're looking at the center of the
you're
donut.
You're inside the donut.
You're inside the donut. This okay. is a very... It's a very empty... It's more like an inner tube donut.
Okay.
But I like donuts better because they're tastier than inner tubes. So, like, you're looking at the center circle part... And you can't see what the person on the other side of the donut can see, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, everyone's got their own view of what that center part looks like.
Right.
So, from a financial point of view, you're looking at it and seeing how much money you can save. And when you are trying to please shareholders or, you know, bosses or whatever, like, you're going to reduce staff to try and increase profits, right? That's
because
mm-hmm. that's what their fucking job is. And they're going to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We should expect them to do that job. That's why they're in that job, right? And then you have, like, the other complete opposite perspective, which is the creative. Like,
mm-hmm.
I love my job. I love what I'm doing. I love being creative. And they're looking at it from a perspective of, I can see how it might affect me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of scary.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's so many other perspectives. Like, from where I'm sitting, it's a little scary from the... It is actually taking jobs away. Like, I've seen studios just use AI for concept art instead. Of like freelance somebody
mm-hmm.
To try and it's faster. Like you could literally go to like, Midjourney. Yeah. You could literally just go to that and have your concept art in 15 minutes as opposed to like go through the contract negotiations, figure out deadlines, have them spend time do it. And studios are opting to do that. I get that. And it's affecting people. So I've seen actual data that it is causing jobs, right? It happens. It's really iterative and will make it so more games can come out in the long term, and it can really aid certain people in their jobs. And like, there's a lot of benefits to it for some people. I see it as what will eventually be, like you said, mocap, a valuable tool for animators to try and make it so the arc of the arm isn't their primary concern. It's more the acting and the aggregate of clips, you know. So it's tough. I don't know where it's going to end up. But I remember, like you said, with the mocap, the money people were looking at it as a replacement. The animators were scared of it. And then we all got to know what it was. We all got to realize it's just another tool. And some studios use it as replacements. Some I've actually witnessed recently, studios that just want you to process the data. And that's your job. And then some studios are like, no, it's just a rough-in. We still need you to animate, you know?
Right.
So I think you're going to get the same with AI. You're probably going to get companies that don't have much vision that just say, we will, you know, just process the AI data. And then some companies with vision that say, okay, here's what it brings to the table. Here's how I'd like you to lean into it. And here's some great things that can come of it that can make your job easier.
Right.
So I don't know. Well, 5 years from now, no, right?
I think less than that, maybe.
Yeah. It's going quick, isn't it?
Yeah. I hope nobody died, because finally we answered that question. Seriously.
Wait, like we were waiting on that one.
Like three people asked for that. Okay. Oh, this is a good one. I know the answer to it, but I need to ask it anyway. Working in an indie game studio.
Ooh. Would you hear that?
That wasn't an ooh for my question. That was an ooh for his neck.
Ooh.
Okay, working in an indie game studio, do you feel closer to the player?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, because they're playing my ideas.
Yeah.
And then my coworkers' ideas that we all get to talk about. God, it's so awesome. Like, in one way, I want to engage with the community more because I'm so connected to it. In another way, it scares me to engage with the community more because I might say something really dumb.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I try and ride that line of like, showcase off something on Twitter or X. I know we did this earlier and I said X. or whatever, LinkedIn or whatever I'm showing it. But then try not to say too many dumb things. but it's just like, I'll like watch playthroughs of Moss just for fun. Like,
yeah,
when I'm in my downtime, just because I just love watching people play the game. And it's not something I did on Destiny or Halo or Condemned or anything like that.
Do you miss guns?
No. Did I answer that quick enough?
Yes. Exactly what I was expecting. All right. This is a question directly from Evan.
Oh, no. Do you need to leave the room while she asks this one?
Being from New Jersey.
Oh, Jesus.
What is your take on the state of pizza and bagels on the West Coast?
We're going to get in trouble. They're going to kick me out. That'd be like putting pineapple on pizza in Jersey. You're out. I'm sorry. You can't stay here. The pizza here is, it's cheese bread.
We can move on.
Cheese bread. The bagels are good. You like the bagels?
Yeah, we like the bagels.
They weren't.
All right, the last question. What is next for Richard?
Wish I could answer that one right now, but I got big plans for the year. I'm going to invest more in my school. I actually haven't updated the school since I published it in 2020.
Okay. Oh, it's brand new. I didn't know it was so new.
Yeah, it's fairly new. Like, I incorporated in 2019, but I didn't go live until January 17th, 2020.
Okay.
Yeah, but I haven't done anything with it since, so I need a new website and all that. I'm going to just redo a lot, address a lot of concerns students had with some of the old lectures. I'm going to make a whole new class on probably gameplay focused, how to make games, animation for games. Yeah, just really dive deeper on that. I can't really say much else other than that right now.
Well, thank you very much for your time and your patience with us.
Well,
we really appreciate it.
This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I think the second time was even better.
Yeah, I think so too. I had a feeling when that happened that the second talk was going to be even better. You know, after the hours of rage.